Welcome to the NewSack at Scale podcast, a show about developing and managing dynamic services and systems. I'm your host, Alex Williams, editor-in-chief, founder at the NewSack. I'm here with Frederick Paul, a longtime tech journalist and now editor-in-chief himself at New Relic. We've wanted to do a show about the new world of scale-led architectures, and New Relic is making that possible, and we want to thank them for their support. Fred is a journalist at heart. We both want this to be an informative show that explains different aspects of scaled-out environments, the ecosystems, and the way these new technologies affect us all. Our goal here is to analyze and explain the multiple different aspects of what scaling requires. We'll explore cloud-native architectures, monitoring, SaaS, and scaling out analytics in a future of transparency between platforms and the infrastructure itself. In addition to speaking with noted guests from the community, we'll be adding special segments that will feature regular guests, stories on particular topics that we develop for the show, commentary, and interviews with people in this new world of scaled-out environments. In this first episode of the show, we'll be discussing cloud-native architecture and what that means. We're going to look at the historical context and how it impacts application development as traditional infrastructure becomes increasingly abstracted to the user, but far deeper in complexity for the operator. Fred, great to have you here for the show. Why don't you tell us a bit about New Relic and introduce our guests for this first episode of the NewSack at Scale.
Thanks, Alex. New Relic is thrilled to sponsor the NewSack at Scale podcast. And in case our listeners are not already aware of what New Relic is all about, we're a software analytics company that delivers real-time insights to customers via a multi-tenant SaaS platform. The New Relic Software Analytics Cloud helps companies securely monitor their production software in virtually any environment without having to build or maintain a dedicated infrastructure. New Relic helps companies improve application performance, create delightful customer experiences, and realize business success from that information. As we like to say at New Relic, life is too short for bad software. I can't wait to get started with the At Scale podcast. Our goal for this premiere episode is to explore the idea of cloud-native applications. Later on in the show, we'll hear what Adrian Cockcroft, a technology fellow at Battery Ventures, had to say about the state of OpenStack and how it needs to be more suited for application development. His comments reflect directly on what we're talking about here. But first, we're pleased to have two guests today here in the New Relic studio who will also help us understand what's going on. Brian Cantrell is the CTO at Joyent. Welcome, Brian. Can you tell us a little bit about Joyent and your background?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. It's a privilege to be here on the inaugural podcast here. I'm the CTO of Joyent. I am a longtime OS guy. I've been doing OS kernel work for two decades now, amazingly enough. I've been at Joyent for about 5 years. Joyent has been a real leader in container-based computing in the cloud. So it's kind of funny for us that everyone else is discovering containers. As I've been fond of saying, we've been in the right place for the wrong time for an extended period of time, and people have kind of finally figured out what we figured out a while ago, which is containers really are the next generation for computing. We're in a step function from VMs to containers, and we've shown that we've got a new service out, the Triton service, that allows people to run containers directly on the metal. And we think that, you know, the rest of the world's figured out what we know, which is containers are absolutely the future.
I kind of have this vision of you on this little planet, you know, out in space saying, Hey, wait a second.
Yeah, where's our atmosphere? Exactly. That's right. No, it's a little bit, it's been like living in the future, you know, and people think like, oh, living in the future must be awesome. It's like, no, it's really not, actually. It can be extremely lonely in the future. So we're very glad that the present has caught up to the future.
Well, congratulations on containers catching up.
Yeah, absolutely.
We also have Patrick Riley, CEO at Kismatic. Thanks for joining us, Patrick. Can you introduce Kismatic and tell us a little bit about your work at Mesosphere as well?
Sure, yeah. So Kismatic's focus is on Kubernetes and pure play Kubernetes, just open source Kubernetes. And formerly I was with Mesosphere. I sold my previous company, Orly Atomics, which was a distributed graph database, to Mesosphere because we had a lot of expertise around distributed C++. And as most people realize, Mesosphere is written in C++. We found that moving on to Kubernetes was interesting because most of the clients that we were talking to were very interested about Kubernetes because of the weight of Google and the type of engineers that were participating in their legacy with Borg and Omega. So we were really excited to start a company, you know, around supporting that.
Thanks a lot. So now that we're all introduced, let's get started. Well, let's start at the basics. What does the term cloud native really mean? And why is the concept getting such attention right now? We talked a little bit about catching up, the future catching up with us. Is that really what's happening?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, cloud native means whatever you want it to mean, of course. It's one of those terms that, it's one of those terms that's obviously strictly positive.
Because I was like, when I first heard it, I'm like, cloud native? I mean, you're talking about like this weird space and time. It's like, were we talking about that like 7 years ago?
Yeah, that's true. And I think that, cloud native is just means awesome, of course. It just means modern computing. But actually, I mean, I think cloud native does actually mean a couple more specific things. Because I think we did this revolution from physical machines to virtual machines led by VMware. And then ultimately that facilitated the cloud, that birthed the cloud. And we didn't really change our computational model when we did that. We were actually operating on hardware-based machines. We were running virtual hardware in the cloud. I mean, witness the Venom exploit was an exploit through a floppy disk controller. A floppy disk being an artifact that my oldest is 10, he would not recognize a floppy disk if I put it in front of him. It would be as if it came, of course, not from the future, but from the past. So the cloud native is really about realizing that we actually don't need to have floppy disk controllers in the future, and that we can actually go to a pure container future, which allows us to do things like, for example, think of not these monolithic services, but microservices, and break up these massive monoliths that are kind of holdovers from the last bubble, from the dot-com boom, and re-architect our applications to be more distributed, ideally more available, but most importantly, more nimble, more agile. I mean, I think what you see across the corporate world, not just kind of here in the Silicon Valley bubble, but you see companies that are realizing that they need to develop software faster, they need to deploy it faster, that software is a competitive advantage. And cloud native computing, to me, is all about expressing that modern way of developing apps such that you can develop and deploy them quickly.
If cloud native means whatever you want it to mean, what do you want it to mean?
I think for me, when I think cloud native, it, much like Brian said, it's kind of a paradigm shift. You got to get people thinking in a different way. Instead of thinking about the physical hardware they have in their own data centers that they can put their hands on, these are servers in the cloud. And now we're taking a step further with things like App Engine, and now a step further with, like, just make a container on your local laptop, get that working, and trust that it's going to work the same way, be it Azure, be it GCE, be it AWS, wherever, you know, DigitalOcean, wherever you want to run it, you know, join.
Hey, join. I'm right here, man. Come on. I mean, it's like, let's just name everybody. I mean, hey, you know, GoGrid, where are you? Come on.
Yeah, but, you know, and back to a point that Brian made earlier that kind of drives me nuts. It's like, if I go all the way back to my OmniTI days, like, we were huge on OpenSolaris and loved zones and everything they could do. And this is like 2006. So when everyone's excited about this stuff now, I'm like, well, we've been doing this since 2006. And we just have different, you know, different names in the mix now. But the concepts are all the same. And for me, when I really think cloud native, I think pushing people towards microservices and re-architecting things so that they're not as brittle and monolithic as they had been historically.
So is there some technological or environmental tipping point that brings us to where we are now, where this is now something we're talking about as opposed to before?
Yeah, I think there are a series of tipping points. And I think that, yeah, that's kind of an interesting question. And it's obviously, any claim is unverifiable, right? Because we can't go back and kind of rerun history. But it does feel like a couple of key technologies brought us to a tipping point. I think that you got to look in part to the languages and to the rise of Node and Go. And it makes it much easier to write a service. I mean, you can bang out a service with not many dependencies and get this thing working in the small, which kind of drives you towards adopting this Unix philosophy when you develop your services, this kind of microservice approach. So you kind of have that simmering. Then in another corner, you have containers simmering. You have folks like Joyent, like Google internally, that realized that containers are actually the right way to develop things. And then you have, I mean, I think they played a very key catalytic role here in terms of Docker realizing that, hey, actually these containers are not just more operationally efficient. They don't just spin up faster, but I can actually use this as an application delivery vehicle where I can take all this kind of dependency nest and I can take this into one binary, one giant statically linked executable that we call a container and ship that into production to achieve what Patrick was describing, where we go from the laptop to running in production and ideally back and forth, where I can know that I can actually go develop my software faster. So I think a bunch of these technologies are helping to contribute here, and there are a bunch of economic factors, and I mean there's a whole series of factors that are contributing.
So Patrick, my question for you is about Kubernetes itself. You know, we talk a lot about containers a lot, but now the conversation is shifting, right? More about orchestration issues and such. What are those concrete benefits that the orchestration provides, you know, and how should we look at that in terms of application development?
Well, I think if we're thinking about Kubernetes, you know, think about the people that originally designed it at Google. They've been working on Borg. It's the same engineers that have been doing that. Everything pretty much runs in a container at Google. So you've got people that had to make everything work, Colossus, like everything they have works in a container. So they're going to make sure that they build the orchestration around the container's needs to talk together. They're going to come up with the concepts of services and replication controllers and things that make sense for the context of trying to make a bunch of containers work together and work well. So it's pretty exciting to me because everything's driven by like, okay, I have a developer that's trying to develop an application, trying to get this in production. You know, we got the whole pets versus cattle kind of analogy. Thing, you know, right in the minds of everyone. And they find ways to make it work.
Explain that to people who may not understand the concept. Well, why it's pertinent.
Well, it's pertinent because you want to treat the containers typically as ephemeral. They can come and go as they want. You're not worried about, you know, I have my MySQL container and I need to make sure that that's always running and always perfect and never goes down. You want to be able to have services in place where you can lose all of your MySQL slaves and you're fine because the data, you know, is going to go wherever the container is going to come back. You're just looking at the processes that are running the service being available in the containers.
That's a metaphor that we've embraced here at New Relic as well, extending it from pets and cattle all the way down to bacteria in terms of that, you know, some of these containers are so ephemeral, they you can't even track them. They're so short-lived.
Wait, I think it's really about cutting the emotional ties that you have. And I think that's part of the reason why I love that metaphor is because, you know, your cattle is going to be named with a UUID, not with a name that you might think fondly of. It's not something where you're going to go SSH onto a machine and kind of, you know, git pull something on there or untar a tarball over here and massage it this way and massage it that way. Because if you actually need to make a change, you're going to redeploy the container and it's going to be a different UUID. And right. You're going to, when you lose that emotional bond, it allows you to transcend from a vegetarian to a carnivore, frankly. You know, you've got no problem devouring these things because you no longer think of like, oh my God, my precious machine.
Right. Well, and that extends to the point where at some point you can't even track them individually. There's no point in it. They lose all individuality entirely because they're so short-lived.
So I have a question about different versions of, when you're running different versions of containers. So you have all the, you know, this vast cattle empire, right? And, you know, and you're a company of any size and you're running, you know, Docker in some of its earlier versions, right? You know, in like 1.0 or to 1.6 or whatever, right? Now they just released 1.8, right? So if you have all these Docker files on in earlier versions that are kind of spread out all over across this, you know, this infrastructure, so to speak, how do you keep things updated? How do you keep, you know, how do you keep the containers updated so they, you know, so they still run or they don't have any vulnerabilities? It seems like there's a lot of complexity in terms of updating the containers itself, or is there not?
I would argue that, you know, platforms like Joyent, you know, speaking for Ryan here, they did a great job of giving you a way to test things and get new versions up, you know, and running on bare metal and getting all the performance benefits of it. And I let you speak to how you guys actually manage version dependencies, but you know, I think it's a much better world to live in than the world of VMs and things that we were dealing with in the past.
Yeah, and I think it's the key is not necessarily the what has happened to the kind of the Docker engine, but rather what the Docker container looks like. And
right.
Can you have an old kind of, what do we do with old containers? Mm-hmm. And fortunately, this is where, and you get to actually part of the value here, is it relies on the fact that what's underlying a Docker container is the Linux system call interface. That's actually what you're executing on. And that container, that Linux system call interface, is essentially stagnant. It's essentially, I guess, stagnant. That sounded like a value judgment. It's stable. There we go. It's stable. It's not stagnant. It's stable.
Hey.
It's delicious, delicious stagnancy. Now, the it's stable, which is great. And that stability allows you to know that you can take a container from the past and run it in the future, which is, I think, what you care about. Now, fortunately, to your specific question, those folks don't really, I mean, the containers that were created with Docker 1.0, actually kind of interesting question if we were on omniscient. Is there any container that was created with Docker 1.0 that's still executing right now? Mm-hmm. It may well be that, fortunately, you know, Docker is moving so quickly mm-hmm. that some of these concerns are concerns that still live in the future a mm-hmm. little bit. Mm-hmm. But there are things that we have seen, and that when you deploy at massive scale, you really begin. You need to begin to think about these kinds of things, versioning and so on. But you also need to begin to think about service composition, and you need to get out from underneath kind of even single containers, even groups of containers, into how I think about that at a higher level. And I think that's part of you know, certainly what Kubernetes has captured, and what we see some of these other frameworks out there as well. They're trying to capture that.
Well, I will say one thing in Kubernetes, like from the beginning, the idea of a rolling update, you know, of services and of containers was always thought of. So there's no way you're going to get stuck of like, okay, we can't get past this Docker daemon version, so we're stuck here. We can't get past this container format, we're stuck here. Like everything's meant to be pretty pluggable and future-proof as much as we can see in the future.
So Patrick, I had a question for you. And the question really is about, you know, how these cloud-native architectures really affect the various elements of the development process and how they affect operations and how it's different compared to, you know, more traditional ways that people have been developing and managing applications.
So if I think, you know, once again, if I step back to my Omni TI days, one of the things that we specialized in were, you know, coming into web properties that started to get popular. They started to get traffic and they started to fall over because the way they designed things, you know, weren't going to meet the demand, you know, of the property. So this is things like Friendster back in the day, early versions.
Oh, Friendster. Man, pour one out for Friendster. Nice.
You know, where they got successful and they're like, well, we don't understand why we can't scale. We can't just add more hardware to it. Like, we're actually having these big issues. And you could slap a little caching on there. You could try a little memcache. You could do some more, you know, slaves for their database. But you still had to re-architect bits and pieces. And where I'm excited about the cloud native stuff, what I'm excited about containers, is now I can actually try a ton of experiments that are going to work in production as well as they work on the laptop. And maybe I grab a Mac Mini and I throw it on the desk, and now I can try a couple different experiments, and I grab a couple more Mac Minis, try a couple more experiments, and I feel comfortable enough, I'm going to promote this to production. And it gives me a chance to take something in the same day. You know, you look at Lyft, for example. They were speaking at the San Francisco, Ryan Lane from Lyft was speaking this week at the San Francisco Microservices Meetup, and he was talking about how their developers now can get something into production in 1 hour from when they actually built it. It can go through all of this tests, and it's not just the container they built on their laptop, it's, you know, the Docker file that they built, and now that's tested, gone through all their CI/CD, the containers put out the other end, they go through all of the different checks, they get it all the way up into a canary deploy, and they can promote it all the way to production traffic within that 1 hour.
You know, and I also think that one of the hidden values, one of the things we don't talk about as much, that for seasoned operators will be actually more important. Whenever you talk about upgrade deployment, a seasoned operator will immediately ask about, well, what about rollback? So mm-hmm. let's just assume that you're perfect, you're a developer, but let's just assume this is garbage and that we deploy this thing and my life is now a living hell. How can I, and anyone who's been in operations has that moment where the system has gone so far sideways, you're thinking, please God, let me get the system back to where it was before I started screwing with it. And you just literally want to get back to where you were. I mean, this is, to me, one of the great values of containers, is what Patrick is describing is all true, but then you can also roll that back. It's like, we actually, it's a bad deploy, you get the canary out there, and it's either not working or what have you, or we actually go live with it, and it's like, and we caught a bug live that we didn't see in the canary, or we can actually roll back to another known image that has all of its dependencies in it, that is completely resolved, that I don't have to worry about. Whereas in a traditional deploy, you've got these piecemeal upgrades that can be really destructive and impossible to roll back from. So I think the rollback is actually just as important as the ability to upgrade.
So you're on the board of advisors at Mesosphere?
Correct.
Okay, and Mesosphere's roots really came out of issues that they were being seen at places like Twitter. Isn't that right?
Yeah, so you know, Ben Hinman co-created Mesos while he was in school. He had done an internship at Google and been exposed to Borg and Omega, got really excited, decided to do his thesis project on Mesos, trying to build his own better version of this.
Importantly, it was called Nexus at the time.
Yeah.
Which I
running on Solaris.
You know, because when Mesos kind of rose to popularity, I'm like, you know, I reckon this sounds a lot like a paper that I reviewed for a computer science conference. And I went back and I realized that I did review the paper, but it was called Nexus.
Yeah, exactly.
So, sorry, please, go on, Patrick.
And then, you know, at this time, Twitter was having kind of the fail whale problems, scaling issues, and exactly kind of the things I talked about that we faced at OmniTI, mm-hmm. you know, going to customers. And Michael Abbott came to AmpLab and said, would you like to work on this at Twitter? You know, Flo was at Twitter, you know, the CEO of Mesosphere at the time. It made a lot of sense. So they came over and actually kind of built the team and built out the rest of the, you know, Apache Mesos while at Twitter and solved those problems. And now you don't see fail whales anymore.
Huh. So one question on what we're talking about here, what is the role of, or not role is perhaps the wrong word, how does the concept of DevOps play into this as cloud native applications are affecting across the board? Does DevOps make it easier to take advantage of these, or is it really just a side process and doesn't really matter?
Well, what is DevOps really anyway?
Right, yeah. Well, we're already talking about cloud native,
everything's what you want it to be. Yeah, you know, DevOps, I don't know. Here's my thing. I think that DevOps, I think, captures a desire to have greater operational empathy from those who develop software, and to have greater software development empathy for those who operate software.
Sure.
I actually believe that you're born a cat or a dog. You're either, and the heart of hearts, you're either an operator or a software developer.
Can't you go to the store and order cultural change? Can't you do that?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I know.
I like the large size box, please.
Exactly. Listen, and I know DevOps is all about having like a big group hug or whatever, but like, which I think is actually, I do think it's great. And now that said, I mean, I don't want to sound overly cynical because I think that.
You kind of do.
Damn it, I'm doing it again. That kind of that cross-functional empathy is actually very important to deliver better artifacts, to deliver a better service, to deliver better software. And what I think that what containers do is it's an acceleration of that. It allows for the developer to really appreciate what's being developed in production and hopefully end the developer excuse of, well, it works for me. And which is, you know, kind of the classic thing. And similarly, I think you want operators to lose the excuse to not upgrade the service, or to lose the excuse, because the other kind of classic pathology we see from operators is that they are overly conservative, and because they didn't develop the software, superstition can arise, and that superstition can prevent you from moving forward with the service. And what I think that containers ideally allow you to eliminate or limit both of those pathologies.
So even if the roles don't change, maybe the mindsets do a little bit.
The mindsets do a little bit. And I think it allows your developers to get closer to operations, allows your operators to get closer to software development.
And that's a conversation that I'm hearing more often. For example, Craig McClucky spoke at OpenStack Silicon Valley this week, and he talked about when they were looking at Google App Engine and they were looking at Google Compute Engine, they saw this huge gap, right? You know, he was drawing the corollary that what we've seen is like this first generation of platform as a service, and a lot of these platforms have been extremely opinionated, right? And so now we're seeing this new generation of platform as a service environments that, you know, that allow you to abstract the infrastructure to some extent, right? I'm curious on what you guys are views about, you know, this discussion about, you know, opinionated systems and how it relates to cloud native applications.
And maybe we should start by defining yeah, exactly what we mean. Again, another fuzzy term perhaps of what we mean when we say opinionated systems.
Well, I think, not to give a definition, but to give an example, you see the large players, you know, in the space, like people like Facebook, and people have a ton of production traffic. They have fine-grained controls of how things make it into production, but they're willing to move fast and break things because they know that they have safeguards in place to be able to, you know, do things like Brian said, roll back, and feel comfortable, you know, where they're at with everything. So at Facebook, you know, they have their own containerization Tupperware that they use. And so they know if they can get things working through all the different stages when they get to production, it's going to work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the big pain that I see over and over again in most places. Like if I step back to my days as senior technical advisor at Wikipedia, we could get developers to complete something and still take a month or two to get it into production because it would become, do we have the hardware to actually run it? Do we know what the scale out's going to be of it? Do we know how popular the feature's going to be? You know, and it could be needing to build up better caching data centers throughout the world. Like all these other things that ops had to handle that developers don't really give them credit for either, because they're not thinking, you know, they're thinking like, well, you go fill out this form, you hit submit, and it does it, and then everything works. And they're like, well, you know, what if a third of the planet's going to use it at the same time? Like how, you know, and ops has all of those considerations to have in play too. So I think with the opinionated systems, you know, it's more about like picking a path that you know is going to work for most of the cases that you face, and forcing people into that model and not having it be so freeform.
Yeah, and I think, you know, an opinion is, I think, at least in software systems, it's often a euphemism for a constraint. that I'm going to place constraints on the problem because that allows me to deliver a better solution. And certainly when you look at a platform as a service, it's a constrained offering that I'm going to take a bunch of things off the table. And I think the classic failing of the platform as a service is that the constraints allowed them to deliver something that's valuable, much more valuable than something that is less constrained. But then those constraints begin to bite you as you want to go scale it out. It's like, well, now actually the constraints were fine when I was just a developer developing this and Hello World works fine. But now that I actually need to scale this to, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions, tens of millions of users, now the constraints are actually butting against me. And I think that one of the great promises of the container revolution is that it allows software developers to effectively ship their own PaaS. John Layden at Couchbase phrases this as software packaged as a service, SPaaS. And it allows a software developer to effectively give you a just add water service. And what that allows us to do is share platforms as a service the way we have shared software. The problem is that in terms of a PaaS, there haven't been very many of them. You've got Google App Engine, you've got Heroku, but a lot of them have failed economically. One you haven't heard of, .cloud, right? Was on its way to oblivion. And then as a Hail Mary, they open sourced their orchestration framework, and that was Docker.
Right.
So, you know, I think that ironically, Docker, in a very kind of roundabout kind of a way, they have helped facilitate the revolution that I think will be the future of platform as a service, which is a bunch of different platforms as a service, not merely one that must appeal to all developers.
This past week, there was the OpenStack Silicon Valley conference at the Computer History Museum, and Adrian Cockcroft was one of the keynotes. And I asked a question after his keynote, and I thought we'd play it and then talk about it, because I think it reflects a lot about what we're talking about here.
I think the community of OpenStack is sort of spends too much time thinking about how to build OpenStack, not enough time about how to build applications on top of it. I've always been a cloud architect of the type who's trying to build applications that run on cloud. So I'm particularly interested in the maturity of the higher-level APIs, the developer experience on OpenStack. And I think that that's where most investment is needed. The downward-facing APIs for managing elements in a data center, that side is where most of the sort of investment's gone over the years. And yeah, there's a lot of problems to solve there. But I think that once you've got a rich upward-facing API, I think there's some good opportunities. For example, Kubernetes is a potentially a good play here. You've got Kubernetes on OpenStack, you've got Kubernetes on anywhere else you want it, and your developers can be operating at that level. So I think that makes sense as kind of up-leveling the way the developer experience, basically.
So I wanted to add that segment because I think it reflects on this discussion about cloud-native architectures and kind of the state of OpenStack, really, where they're talking about are containers. And so I just thought it was interesting in the context of the conversation about OpenStack, and I'm just curious on, you know, what your thoughts are about the context of OpenStack in terms of cloud-native.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what Adrian is saying, if you read between the lines, I think is that OpenStack is fundamentally at the wrong level, and what he's saying is that they need to listen a lot more to the folks that are actually trying to build real apps with OpenStack. Now that's going to be a challenge because you said that it was at the Computer History Museum. I wonder if they should open a Software History Museum, of which OpenStack may be a very prominent exhibit, because I think that the problem with OpenStack, and this is, you know, something that we have been pointing out for a while, but when you have a collaboration that is defined the way the OpenStack collaboration is defined, namely among vendors, it is basically doomed. This is basically, if you remember the common desktop environment from back in the 90s, where HP, Sun, and IBM got together and decided they were going to develop a graphical user interface. I mean, it sounds like, what's the punchline? Well, the punchline is CDE, and it was just as bad as you can imagine because it was a least common denominator thing. No one could kind of offend one another. What they understood is what they were trying to sell, not what people were trying to do. OpenStack has been vendor-driven, and it has not been about making things. It's been about selling things. And that's fundamentally misguided. And Adrian, I'm being a little more blunt than Adrian is, but he's saying the same thing. What he's saying is you're focusing on the wrong thing. You're talking about how this thing is made, not what I can go do with it. And as a result, what they have done, I think, is fundamentally ill-equipped to take us forward.
Not that I'm biased.
Well, and I can give a concrete example of this. Like, while I was still at Wikipedia, we built the largest OpenStack cluster that, you know, that there was. It was bigger than anyone at the time. And our goal was to be able to replicate all of Wikipedia for a developer so that they could have a sandbox to play with everything from Elasticsearch to the front-end Apaches to their own Puppet repos and, like, know that anything they did wasn't going to affect production and they could get things into production quicker. One of the mandates that we have at the Wikimedia Foundation was that everything has to be open source. We can't use anything, you know, from a vendor or proprietary. So all the time I would say, oh, awesome, OpenStack has this thing. And then, you know, go back to Ryan Lane and the ops team, like, oh, can we do this? And he's like, well, no, because that's a Piston thing. That's only in Piston's version. And they haven't open sourced that part. And I'm like, well, can we, like, find the open source version? I'm like, well, no, there isn't. No one has that. And so there wasn't even the... Even though, you know, open's in the name, no one really thought how to open source things first. It was always a vendor better version of it. And then maybe if it got enough traction, it would be open source later. And it just became very, very frustrating.
So then why Kubernetes? Why is Google getting involved in this at this point with Kubernetes?
If I think about the way I've said it to people in the past, it's like we've got this snow globe where all the flakes landed on AWS. And Google just wants to shake that snow globe a little bit and get some of those flakes to land back on Google, you know, Google's compute engine. Mm-hmm. And a good way to do that is to take all the lessons they've learned internally with Borg and Omega, start a greenfield effort of that, make it very portable. And now if I can drive down costs by bin packing hosts and needing a lot less compute than I would, you know, normally spend, I can take an AWS customer, get them to run everything with Kubernetes, and drive their costs from $150,000 a month down to $65,000 a month. And then if I'm Google, I can say, hey, I'm going to lower the price of, you know, our cloud by 3 times. And could you just switch over?
So, Brian, we have this Cloud Native Compute Foundation. You're on one of the project managers or overseers.
God. Oh, come on. That was uncalled for. What is that about? Do I owe you money or something?
You're the CEO of Joy.
Yeah, exactly. Good God. You're going to get my title wrong. At least go the right direction.
So they have a funny way of describing you, though, on the CSES. It's like project advisor or something like that.
Yes, the technical oversight committee.
So CNC.
Thank you not to refer to my committee membership as program management.
So what is the purpose of CNCF, then?
Well, so I think, and actually, you know, you were talking about, well, why is Google involved in OpenStack? I think you need to really take apart, into a long way to answer your question, you need to take apart Google's involvement in OpenStack. I think Google views OpenStack as a potential substrate for Kubernetes. They're not walking into OpenStack saying, hey, listen up, you misguided jerks. We're actually going to do something that's actually valuable to people. That's not what they're doing at all. They're participating in OpenStack to be able to view it as a substrate for Kubernetes, not to be able to, I think, hijack it or redirect it. I think now, by contrast, the Cloud Native Computing Foundation, actually, I think one thing we all have in common, even those that have been involved in the OpenStack effort, so we view OpenStack as a bit of an anti-pattern, is how can we not fall into the CDE OpenStack trap? And we're in this kind of funny position where we want to work together as an industry to build the future because we build better things that way. But we don't want to collaborate so tightly that we end up in endless committees, fights, elections, everything else that OpenStack has done to go sideways and where things are kind of putatively open but actually closed. So how do we do that? And I was kind of racking my brain about it, like, wow, is there even a model? I mean, can we all get along? Maybe we can't. Maybe we can't do this. And then, of course, the historical analog hit me. Of course, the IETF is the historical analog. So the IETF is the Internet Engineering Task Force, and this is the group of people that actually built the internet. The reason we have an interoperable internet is because of the IETF, and they managed to navigate a bunch of vendor disputes and a bunch of bad vendor behavior. They navigated a lot of that and got to a much better internet. And how did they do it? Well, they emphasized the interfaces. The idea of a request for comments, an RFC, where you would fully document your interface, where you would do it without your, you would have your corporate affiliation, but it's not coming from your corporation. You have to have your individual name on an RFC. So it's not, I'm not getting Cisco's position. I'm getting a particular engineer at Cisco who wrote this document. And they often wrote that document with someone at Juniper. And that document fully specifies the API. And then really importantly, one thing I love about the IETF, and I don't know if we can get an analog for this in the CNCF or not, but I hope we can, is that the IETF mandated that you had two implementations of an interface before it could be called a standard. Two different implementations had to talk to one another. And I think one of the things that we're looking for out of the CNCF, or certainly speaking personally, I would like to see out of the CNCF, is not merely standards, but artifacts, stacks that you can actually stand up and run. But I don't want to be so monolithic about it that I don't want to pick winners. I want to allow for innovation. I want to allow for people, I want to allow for multiple implementations. I think that's the other problem with OpenStack, is that there's no kind of competition in the core of OpenStack. It's all at the proprietary fringes. If you can create some healthy competition at the core, you can get to better implementation. So I think that I'm really looking at the IETF as a model. I think we're trying to pick the best of the Apache Foundation, the best of OpenStack, which frankly is in marketing. OpenStack did a really admirable job on marketing, and then the best of these other organizations like the IETF.
Well, I think one thing to add too is even in the container formats themselves, what we're trying to do with OCI. And make sure that we have standards set up forth there as well. Because to me, when CoreOS did Rocket and Rocket came on the scene, for our Cosmatic customers, it made people hit the pause button hard. They were in this like, okay, this is VHS versus Betamax. I don't know which one to choose. I'm not going to pick one and go to production with the wrong one, then have to retool, everything. So we need to follow these models to make sure that things are interoperable. And that's the key piece, I think, of what you said.
No, I think that's exactly right. And I think that you want these things to be interoperable. You want the interfaces to be really well-defined, which, by the way, will force us collectively to slow down a little bit and document some of these things. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest knock on any of these projects is that they are moving so fast mm-hmm. that the poor person left trying to deploy this they're looking at five versions of documentation, all of which are mutually incompatible with one another, and figuring out where's the real documentation. And too often, you actually got to read the source for that particular issue. It's like, well, that's actually unacceptable. So,
and the fact that you can read a blog post that's 2 months so about Kubernetes, and now we don't even have the same command, we don't even have the same flags, you can't even find what you're looking for in the documentation. Like, we have to do the unsexy work of documenting things.
Right, and maybe you got to find the people for whom that is sexy work. I mean, because for me personally, like, there's nothing sweeter than having a really crisp API, implementing that API, and knowing that you've kind of got every T crossed, every I dotted, knowing that, but that does require you to actually slow down and not be focused quite so much on like how many bazillions of committers do we have?
Or how many stars do we have on GitHub?
How many stars do we have on GitHub? I mean, and you actually need to slow down a little bit, and we actually need to get and especially now that, like the world gets it, containers are the future, let's get it right. We're laying the substrate for the future. Let's not have a podcast in 20 years where someone who is now 20 is decrying the poor decisions that were made now. And we've seen that happen time and time again in history, where bad decisions are made because people don't consider the ramifications.
Well, great. Well, you guys, thank you so much for joining us on the show here for our first episode. Really appreciate you participating. Brian, thanks for coming by. Patrick, thank you. And we look forward to seeing you guys. And I see you guys all the time on the road. So see you at the next thing.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for coming, guys. And thank you, Alex. It's been a real pleasure co-hosting the New Stack at Scale with you. And New Relic is super excited to participate in this. And we're looking forward to joining you every month to do this again. I also want to invite our listeners to check out New Relic's own Modern Software podcast, which will be premiering soon. And you'll be able to find it in all the usual spots, or check it out on the New Relic blog at blog.newrelic.com.
Great. Well, that covers it for this first show of the New Stack at Scale. Thanks, Fred. And talk to you in September, when we will discuss with our guests how to manage the underlying complexity of scaled out services. We'll just cover it all right there in that one discussion.
Oh, that'll be the one to listen to. It's got all the answers.
Great, guys. Well, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
And finally, I'd like to thank our engineers, Vinny Garcia and Billy Clayton, and back in Portland, Luke Leffler, our audio engineer for the New Stack at Scale. We'll see you next month.